From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
They show the way these guys think. If you've got a hanging black man on your arm, you're more likely to commit a crime against a black person. The Klan thing is the same way. It's motive, intent, state of mind. We'll tie it all together with some experts later on.
Tattoos, a chain, and a jailhouse vow. Southern injustice. Today we go down to Jasper for the trial. Then the story of Albert Woodfox and Herman Wallace, who organized the Black Panther Party at Louisiana's Angola prison. A story about why they've spent more than two decades in solitary confinement. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A logging chain has become an emotional piece of evidence in the trial of a white man accused of dragging an African-American man to his death in Jasper, Texas. Prosecutors say the chain was attached to the bumper of a pickup truck and wrapped around the ankles of James Byrd, a 49-year-old African-American man who was dragged with it for 3 miles. Testimony in the murder trial of Bill King resumes this morning. We'll have more on that story in just a few minutes. Western embassies began evacuating staff, and NATO troops stood poised at Yugoslavia's border today, ready to pull international monitors to safety as the deadline approaches for a peace agreement for Kosovo. Hopes for a last-minute breakthrough were dealt a blow as Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic insisted he will not back down over the province, even if NATO goes through with promised airstrikes. With NATO threatening airstrikes, should tomorrow's noon deadline pass without an accord between Serbs and ethnic Albanians, some residents of Kosovo's provincial capital, Pristina, started stocking up on food, fearful of both airstrikes and retaliatory attacks by Serb forces. Meanwhile, Russian officials are trying to clear up the confusion sparked by some remarks on Kosovo by Boris Yeltsin. The country's presidential press service now says the Russian president sent President Clinton a letter this week warning against airstrikes in Yugoslavia. Yeltsin caused a stir yesterday when he said he'd warned Clinton by phone and letter that Russia would not tolerate military strikes against the Serbs. Pounding rebel bases in northern Iraq and hunting fighters in hideouts, Turkey's army is bearing down hard on a Kurdish guerrilla group following the capture of its leader. The Turkish military released no casualty figures from the fighting in northern Iraq against Kurdish rebels loyal to Abdullah Öcalan, who was abducted by Turkish commandos in Kenya on Monday. With Öcalan's rebel Kurdistan Workers Party, or PKK, apparently leaderless, the military kept up its latest incursion into neighboring northern Iraq in pursuit of guerrillas who have bases there. Today's New York Times reports that Attorney General Janet Reno is thinking of appointing a special prosecutor to look into charges of misconduct by independent prosecutor Ken Starr. The paper says one possibility is to pick a U.S. attorney with solid Republican credentials. That person would supervise a team of FBI agents and Justice Department prosecutors. Officials have said that such an investigation would examine allegations that Starr's deputies improperly offered Lewinsky immunity on condition she not discuss it with her attorney. There's also a claim that Starr and his aides may have had contacts with lawyers for Paula Jones that were not disclosed when he obtained Reno's approval to investigate the Lewinsky case. Colombia's main right-wing paramilitary group freed two human rights workers yesterday, ending a three-week kidnapping ordeal that caused international outrage. Four directors of the Popular Training Institute rights groups were snatched at gunpoint from their headquarters in the northwestern city of Medellin on January 28th. Two of them, both women, were released by the ultra-right-wing United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia on February 8th. The other, which includes the center's director, were finally released at an undisclosed location in the northern province of Cordoba. Two anti-nuclear weapons protesters were sentenced yesterday to between 30 and 41 months in prison for damaging an underground silo containing a Minuteman missile equipped with a nuclear warhead. U.S. District Judge Walker Miller in Denver reluctantly sentenced Daniel Sicken of Brattleboro, Vermont, to 41 months in jail and Sacho Coe of Ridgewood, New Jersey, to 30 months. The defendants had been convicted of using a sledgehammer and chisel to damage doors, conduits, concrete, and rails in a Colorado missile silo last August 6th, the 53rd anniversary of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima, Japan, by the United States. The Vatican has contacted the British government about former Chilean dictator General Augusto Pinochet, who's been in police custody in Britain since October and is fighting extradition to Spain, where he faces charges of genocide and terrorism. The British Foreign Office minister said today the Vatican had written to Britain to inquire about the arrest of Pinochet. A Foreign Office spokesperson, speaking on condition of anonymity, said a reply had been sent to the Vatican but did not elaborate. And that's some of the news at this hour. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. White supremacist John William King, accused of dragging a black man to death behind a pickup truck, vowed in prison to kidnap and kill a black man when he got free. This according to a former fellow inmate who testified yesterday at his trial. William Hoover said King, who was in jail until 1997 for burglary, planned the killing as part of a gang initiation rite known behind bars as a blood tie. Prosecutors in King's capital murder trial say the plan became reality on June 7, 1998, when James Byrd was murdered near Jasper, a small town 100 miles northeast of Houston. King could face the death penalty if convicted. He's pleaded not guilty in the case. We now go to Jasper, Texas, where Pacifica Radio's Jeremy Scahill is covering the trial. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jeremy.
Thank you, Amy.
So tell us how the case has gone so far with the prosecutors opening. What were their major arguments?
Well, it's interesting. The day before the trial began, the district attorney here in Jasper County, Guy James Gray, said that the evidence he was going to present, the case that he was going to present about the brutal murder of James Byrd Jr. was going to be more heinous than anyone had imagined, and that the story was going to be more shocking even than had been told so far. And, of course, listeners know that the story in and of itself is gruesome. James Byrd Jr., a disabled African-American man, after attending an anniversary party, where there was drinking, had walked home. No one would give him a ride because they said that he was either too intoxicated, and one other person said that their conscience just plain told them not to. And so he was left to walk home from this party, sort of in the center of Jasper, to his home some distance away. And according to the prosecution, John King, Russell Brewer, and Sean Berry picked him up in a pickup truck late that June evening, and he voluntarily got in the truck. And as the evening went on, they drove him to a location that was not his home. A fight ensued. They chained him to the back of a pickup truck. And at the scene there, we understand that they spray painted his face black to humiliate him. And as one of the leaders of the Nation of Islam down here in Texas pointed out, they had time to celebrate as they did it because investigators found cigarette butts and beer bottles at the scene. They then chained him to this truck and dragged him back and forth on a 3.08-mile stretch of road until he was decapitated, his arm came off, his torso, and eventually they found his legs with his underwear around the ankles. So the brutality of this case, as it was, I think, shocking to anyone who heard about it. But the district attorney guy, James Gray, promised that the evidence that he would present would shock people even more. And what he said was that this was not a case of just three drunken rednecks or racists out to murder a black man. He said that this was part of a broader effort by Bill King in particular, who is on trial down here today, to establish a white supremacist group in Jasper, Texas. This was to be known as the Texas Rebel Soldiers, which was going to be a branch of the Confederate Knights of America, which is a North Carolina-based gang.
Jeremy, I think we have actually the comment of the prosecutor that you recorded just outside of the outside the Jasper courthouse.
You have to really take the tattoos all together. The first clue to them is they both belong to the same gang, Confederate Knights of America. That helps explain why they act together and what they'll want to do in the future. We'll have an expert in a day or two that will take those kind of things and tie them together. But obviously, you can't commit a crime this heinous unless you got a lot of hate and anger in your heart.
Jeremy, that's the Jasper County District Attorney, Guy James Gray. But the defense says that's not enough to prove that Bill King committed murder. Is that right?
That's right. The defense lawyers, Sonny Cribbs and Brack Jones, have been arguing that it is Bill King's First Amendment rights to have those tattoos, and he pointed out to the press that he has the same freedom of speech rights as others. The judge, however, did not agree with that argument, and so he turned down that objection. He overruled their objection, and Brack Jones and Sonny Cribbs spoke to reporters outside the courtroom, and this is what they had to say.
We just feel like that's an appropriate objection to make to the tattoos and any of the gang affiliation and related testimony on that or any of his beliefs that he has. He's got a right to express any opinion he does just like you do. And obviously the state's trying to prove that his opinions caused this particular incident. And they've at least argued to the judge that those opinions, the tattoos, and his beliefs are part of the motive, intent, scheme, and design of this particular offense, which we objected to it and it's been overruled. So now it's in.
And you know, Amy, it's interesting. Now that those tattoos are in, the prosecution has done a lot of talking about them, but not only talking, they introduced into evidence 33 color photographs that they displayed to the jury and those of us who were in court that show an intricate weave on Bill King's body of tattoos that are Nazi symbols, racist symbols, and some that the prosecution called satanic. You have to understand, an estimated 65% of Bill King's upper body is covered in these tattoos. One of the tattoos is a woodpecker because a saying for white people in prison apparently is a peckerwood, and so it's a woodpecker peeking out from behind a Ku Klux Klan outfit. In the eyes of that woodpecker are two Nazi SS lightning bolts in each of the eyes, and the woodpecker is pointing to a crystal ball, and in that crystal ball is a black man hanging from a tree. Another of them is the what they call the patch for the Confederate Knights of America. It's a labeling of white Aryan gang members in prison, and both Bill King and one of the other defendants in this case, Russell Brewer, have that patch, and underneath Bill King's it says Aryan Pride. There's also one that has a baby Jesus figure with horns on its head. And observers here in Jasper say that's probably the one that's going to shock the jury the most. Beyond the racist tattoos, there's a sense here that they'll be just absolutely disgusted with what they would interpret to be a desecration of a religious figure.
And the lawyers, the prosecution, also talked about these tattoos as well as you recorded them outside the courthouse.
They show the way these guys think. If you've got a hanging black man on your arm, you're more likely to commit a crime against a black person. The Klan thing is the same way. It's motive, intent, state of mind. We'll tie it all together with some experts later on.
And you know, Amy, it's interesting. Not only have they been talking about the tattoos and trying to establish a motive and intent here, but they've also been talking about some of the evidence that was recovered in Bill King's apartment. And one of the things they found was a folder that contained dozens of documents that were rife with racist overtones. And these writings cast Bill King as sort of a supremacist hero fighting what he believed was a coming race war. And in these documents, King writes that the struggle against people of color and Jews required, quote, sometimes illegal activities that have proven vital to our survival on many occasions. And constantly are we getting more and more prophetic things in this thing, things of to come. And yesterday we had the most explosive testimony to date in this trial when one of Bill King's former prison buddies, a member of a white gang called the Aryan Brotherhood, a prison gang named William Hoover, testified. And he said in testimony that his life was in jeopardy by him showing up. He was testifying against his will, but he did testify that Bill King told him that when he got out of prison, he intended to kidnap a black man, put him in the trunk of a car, and drive him to the woods. Each day it seems, you know, more and more shocking how evil Bill King is being portrayed to be.
We're talking to Jeremy Scahill, who actually right now is in the basement of the courthouse in Jasper, Texas, where in just a couple hours, the trial of John William King, known as Bill King, will resume. What is the courthouse like, Jeremy?
Well, Amy, it's really something. The whole scenario here is like something out of a John Grisham novel. You have this very old-fashioned courthouse with ceiling fans, and it has stained glass windows and the founding fathers of Jasper's picture, you know, wrap around the courtroom. You've got this jury of 11 whites and only one African-American. The prosecution said that they that wasn't their choice, but that the defense had struck down some of the other jurors.
What is the composition of the town racially?
Well, the town of Jasper itself is roughly 45% African-American and 50% white, with 5% of other races. But the greater Jasper area is a much whiter area. So when we're talking about the town itself, we're talking about a pretty diverse community. And actually, Jasper has a reputation in the east of Texas, which is traditionally racist, as being far more progressive than the others on the issue of race. But then you have the defense counsel named Sonny Cribbs, who is a he seems like a very brilliant defense lawyer, and he's a veteran defense lawyer from Beaumont, Texas. And then the prosecution team, Guy James Gray, is a very well-respected figure here, and the defense team that he's put together as well. You know, but it's interesting that Bill King sits in court every day, and he has his left hand sort of covering over his mouth, and he sits slouched over, and he hardly ever flinches. There are his love letters to women that are put forth. He shows no reaction. They brought in the 24-foot chain that prosecutors say was used to drag James Byrd Jr. to his death and dismember him. No reaction from Bill King. His old prison buddies testify against him. No reaction. And they have him dressed up like a preppy college student with his hair combed to the side. But underneath his plaid button-down collar shirt and his khaki pants lie a court-ordered stun belt and 65% of his upper body covered with racist and anti-Semitic tattoos.
Now, Jeremy, I understand there were a group of women outside of the courthouse that you recorded that were very upset about the way Bill King is transported around to and from the courthouse.
Well, what's interesting about that, Amy, is that he is not being transported in a police vehicle. He's being transported in a tiny sports car, and he's being dressed up in his street clothes. And so there are roughly 25 to 30 people, primarily African-American women, who did gather outside there to tell not only Bill King, but the authorities what they thought about this. And that's the cut we're going to hear now.
How does it feel to kill a black man? Did it make you feel good? Do your tattoos mean anything?
When we go to jail, we have to get in a police car and he gets to ride in a luxury car. That's not fair. That's not fair.
Why is he not having on an orange suit like the rest of them?
We have to wear orange. We have to get in a police car in the back seat.
As the women talk about when African Americans are arrested, they end up being put in orange jumpsuits and being put in, police vehicles.
And that woman actually went on to say that it just goes to show you that this town is what everybody says it is, prejudice. But it's interesting, you know, if you talk to people, particularly I've talked to a lot of older people as well, and they say that they feel that this is a terrible way for Jasper to get put on the map, and that this is not going to be forgotten anytime soon by the community here. I think it really has devastated people, both African-Americans and white people here. But there's a very understandable rage that people have, and increasingly you're seeing members of the African-American community come out to attend the trial or to congregate on the lawn outside of the trial. There has not been a presence from the Ku Klux Klan that we know of here, nor has Khalid Mohammed come around. There was one day when a member of the Nation of Islam from Houston did come in, Quanel X, and he has been one of the sort of central figures to protesting John King and also the Klan here.
Finally, Jeremy, the issue of DNA. The prosecution said they would present it today. Could be the last day of the prosecution case. Is that right?
Yeah, there's a couple things that could happen today that could be quite interesting. The first is that they've been going through what's actually a very boring chain of custody establishment, who had the evidence when, and bringing it all the way to the point now where you have the people who analyzed the DNA. And they're going to link the tennis shoes and the blood and also James Byrd's clothes to these three men, as well as the truck. And the defendants, according to the prosecution, washed off the chain, so they can't link that to them, but they believe that the chain they presented yesterday was, in fact, the chain that was used to drag him. The thing that could be really explosive today, though, is that one of the three men accused in this murder, Sean Berry, may testify today against Bill King. And if that happens, that would pretty much sink Bill King.
And the prosecution is saying that Bill King is the ringleader?
Yeah, they're saying that he was the mastermind of this and that he intended to kidnap a black man to try to commit a heinous crime that would draw attention to the establishment of a white supremacist group. He has written prolifically from a white supremacist perspective. He is a member of a white supremacist organization, the Confederate Knights of America. In fact, he's an exalted cyclops in that group. And he hoped to establish what would be called the Texas Rebel Soldiers here in Jasper.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, and we'll get the latest report on what happens today and over the weekend from you on Monday. Jeremy Scahill, thanks for being with us from the basement of the courthouse in Jasper, Texas.
Thank you, Amy.
And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Hold it now!
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. More than 25 years after he was convicted and sentenced to life in solitary confinement by an all-white jury for the killing of a white prison guard at Angola State Penitentiary in Louisiana, former Black Panther Albert Woodfox was retried last December for the same killing. After a highly politicized retrial in which the prosecutor brought up Woodfox's Black Panther activities and statements he made against police, he was once again convicted for the murder of the guard named Brent Miller, who was stabbed to death in April of 1972. Woodfox will be resentenced on Tuesday, February 23rd, and is expected to receive life without parole. At the time of the killing of the guard, Woodfox was in prison for armed robbery. He and another prisoner, Herman Wallace, had founded the first chapter of the Black Panther Party in prison. At a time when Angola had the reputation of being the most violent prison in the country, many say the party had been successful in stemming violence between prisoners and had fought to get rid of corruption within the guards. Only one person witnessed Miller's murder, another prisoner named Hezekiah Brown. At first, Brown said he couldn't identify the killer because his face had been covered, but after a few days of questioning by the authorities, Brown changed his story and identified four men, including Woodfox and Wallace. One of the four prisoners, Chester Jackson, agreed to testify for the prosecution without any physical proof that Woodfox and Wallace had committed the murder, and relying exclusively on the testimony of the other two prisoners, Woodfox and Wallace were tried, convicted, and sentenced to life in prison without parole. They've been held in solitary confinement for over 2 decades. Years later, prison documents obtained by Woodfox confirmed that both Brown and Jackson were paid off with sentence reductions and other incentives. An extensive paper trail left by Angola's then warden, who's now himself in prison for the attempted murder of his wife, shows an extensive cover-up and possible frame-up of Woodfox and Wallace. Woodfox was granted a new trial, re-indicted in 1993 by a grand jury that included the wife of the former warden, who previously had written a book on the prison that talks about the murder of the guard. Pacifica's Leslie George recently spent a week in Louisiana and interviewed Woodfox and others involved in the case. And she brings us this documentary, Freedom Behind Bars.
Louisiana has been racist for, it dates way back. You got people who've been here all their life, raised people to be racist, their children and their children to be like that, and it dates way back.
Angola was an example of one of the worst, if not the worst, prison in the country.
This woman kept asking me, did not kill Officer Miller, and I kind of was angry, and I just looked at her and told her, you know, I said, Miss Cullen, you know I didn't kill Officer Miller just because you know I passed a lie detector test.
They don't care, really, who carried out the killing. They want someone to pay, and the authorities want Woodfox and Wallace to pay because they were the leading organizers to change those brutal conditions.
Basically, the state put the Black Panthers on trial, and the state convicted the Black Panthers.
America during the 1960s and 70s was torn apart by segregation, racism, sexism, the Vietnam War, and poverty. Individuals like Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, Malcolm X, and Ella Baker rose to meet the difficult challenges presented to them by history. And then there were the other freedom fighters, uncelebrated and unsung, who were resisting the most oppressive conditions in America's prisons. Prisoners across the country were organizing, and while having some limited successes, they paid a very heavy price, some paying with their lives, as in the Attica massacre ordered by then-New York Governor Nelson A. Rockefeller. The revolutionary attitude was to use any means necessary, whether filing civil suits in state or federal courts, going on work stoppages or hunger strikes, or taking guards hostage. Two such revolutionaries are Albert Wood Fox and Herman Wallace, who would become known as the Angola Two. Freedom Behind Bars is their story.
Young man lands in jail for some crime he did not commit. 352 years hard labor in Angola prison. 352 years in hard labor. Sleepless nights between sugar cane and cotton. It's where he learns the ropes. Pays with his soul for some crime he did not commit.
Angola Prison is situated on the Mississippi River in southeastern Louisiana and covers more than 18,000 acres of farmland. The state penitentiary is made up of several former plantations whose antebellum slaves had come from the African country of Angola. Angola is considered one of the worst prisons in the country. Richard Becker is an organizer with the International Action Center and on the Angola 2 Defense Committee.
There were widespread killings, torture, the systematic rape and enslavement of young prisoners who were brought in to the yard, and all kinds of abuses which translated into not only power but profit.
Serving terms for armed robbery, Albert Wood Fox and Herman Wallace began working together shortly after arriving at Angola in 1971. They immediately started organizing, eventually establishing the first chartered chapter of the Black Panther Party behind bars. Wood Fox first encountered the Black Panther Party when he was 22 in Harlem.
When I initially joined the Panthers, it was basically the first time that I had saw African-American people that were not afraid. And that made the greatest impact in my life. When I saw these young African men and women walking around in the communities proud and fearless and dedicated and focused, at some point in time, I think I made a deal with myself that I was never going to be afraid again and that I would face and stand against injustice no matter what form I encountered it in, no matter where I encountered it in, no matter what the cost would be to me.
Wood Fox was in New York after having escaped from the Orleans Parish prison in 1969. Within days, he was picked up and placed in the Manhattan Detention Center, known as the Tombs. There, he encountered Black Panther Party members.
I was on a tier with, I think it was two or three Black Panther Party members. I used to sit down, we used to talk, these, you know, trying to educate everybody on the tier. We used to talk about various things, have debates about politics and the judicial system, criminology, crime, and how it was tied into the economic conditions in the country. That was the beginning of my political activism.
Identified as a militant as a result of his association with the Black Panthers in New York, after his extradition back to the Orleans Parish prison, he was placed on a tier with 12 Black Panthers who were on trial for their alleged involvement in a police shootout. At one of their daily political education classes, Wood Fox and the Panthers decided to take an action against the deplorable conditions in the jail.
We have to go do something. So we initially agreed upon to take the tier officer who was working the tier hostage. You know, they use the term hostage, we say house arrest. So that morning, that's what they did. When they went out to dress out to go to court, they overpowered him. You know, there wasn't no brutality used, or he wasn't in anything. We just told him, look, we're trying to get a point across. We need you to come on the chair. We're going to put you in a cell. And nothing's going to happen and stuff. So at that point, he stopped offering any type of resistance. We brought him back, put him in the cell on the chair. And we got on the communication system from the chair to the control center in Orleans Parish Prison. And made known to the supervisor that we had the tier officer under house arrest, and that we wanted to see members of the media. After that, they made a lot of changes. They removed all the steel plates off of C1, for one thing. They started cleaning the tiers. They agreed to upgrade the food, establish a prison law library, have tier representatives, have meetings weekly or bi-weekly. Consideration in the court for lesser bails for, crimes that were not that serious, to relieve some of the overcrowding that was in Parrish Prison at that time. Things to that effect. Those were mostly some of the demands we were making.
It was the summer of 1971. After the success of the Panthers' direct action, Woodfox became an official member of the organization. Shortly thereafter, he was sent to Angola, where some 4,000 mostly African-American inmates were incarcerated.
The dormitory was in a state of decay. You had no screens on the windows in the summertime. The mosquitoes would virtually eat you alive. In the wintertime, they had no heating system. You would virtually freeze to death. Inmates were sent out to work in the fields without the proper clothing. Come rain or come shine, things like boots, working shoes, gloves, raincoats, and stuff like it. They usually went somewhere else. Various foods that were brought or raised right there on the farm for inmate consumption went who knows where to who knows who.
You can't stop running water. Can't kill the fire that burns inside. Don't deny our flesh and blood. Don't forsake our sons and daughters.
Woodfox says the prison administration used racial divisiveness to control the inmate population. Choice positions such as clerical, supervisory, and medical jobs went to white inmates, while for the most part black prisoners slaved outside in the fields of the former plantations. Woodfox says his and Wallace's pledge to the Black Panther Party led them to
educate the inmates about unity, about trying to instill in them some dignity, pride, self-respect for themselves, some integrity, trying to instill in them that the fact that they were in prison didn't mean that they were worthless, that they had some value as a human being. The only way that this would benefit them if they would adapt certain moral principles and values and try to uphold those things instead of trying to survive in the culture, the prison culture, that the administration and security had created, to try to create our own environment, one that would allow us to be human beings.
Their initial campaign was to stop prison rapes.
When we decided that we were going to protect these young men inmates from being raped, we virtually drew the wrath of everybody in the institution, inmates, security guard, everything, because this was, to the inmates, this was depriving them of one of their privileges. To administration security, this was depriving them of one of their weapons of control, one of their methods of controlling and dividing inmate population. I mean, it's pretty hard to tell another inmate about, talk to another inmate about unity and coming together when you done raped him. We were aware that this would be a bold move on our part and that there was a possibility of violence involved. We talked about it and we decided what we would do is that every Thursday, which was called Fresh Fish Day, when inmates classified in the population would come down, that we would arm ourselves and we would go down there and we would escort them. We would introduce ourselves and we would escort them to whatever dormitory that they were assigned to. And we would talk to them. We would explain to them what could get them, the type of games that would be used. The term for raping an inmate was to turn him out. We told them that if they needed anything, try to come to somebody that knew was in the Panther Party, and we would try to assist them if they needed, soap or toothpaste or deodorant or they just wanted something to eat, with the time they used in prison as zoos, they just wanted something to eat, and they could come to us and we would try to help them. And we put the word out, you know, amongst the inmate population that, you know, if you mess with someone under our protection, then you had to deal with the Black Panther Party. It pretty much stopped.
On April 17, 1972, a white security guard, Brent Miller, was found dead in a black dorm, stabbed 32 times. Authorities say Miller was killed between 7:25 and 7:45 in the morning while most prisoners were at breakfast. His body was found in a corridor of the Pine One dormitory. Within 2 hours of finding Miller's body, Wallace, other activist inmates, and later Woodfox were placed in Closed Cell Restricted, or CCR. 2 days after the murder, Hezekiah Brown, a convicted rapist serving a life sentence, testified he saw Woodfox, Wallace, and another inmate, Chester Jackson, commit the murder. Within days, Brown also fingered Gilbert Montague as another murderer. However, Brown's testimony would soon prove to be itself suspect.
Brown claimed that the initial stabbing by me started on his bed, and there was a scuffle on his bed. But if you look at the pictures of the crime scene, you'll see that his bed is unruffled in any way. There's no blood on his bed. There's no blood leading from his bed to the corridor in the front of the dorm where Officer Miller's body was found. There's no blood trail. There were no shoe prints of found. You know, I mean, if you stab someone 32 times, blood is flowing. And blood is going to hit the floor. The coroner, Dr. Gould, he testified that, in his opinion, Officer Miller put up a tremendous scuffle. So that alone would tell you that there's going to be blood everywhere. There's got to be bloody fingerprints, bloody shoe prints, or whatever.
There was never any testimony from anybody that there would have been blood all over everybody around and all over the walls and the mattresses and all of this.
Assistant Attorney General Julie Cullen, who prosecuted Woodfox the second time.
There was a lot of contact, close contact, the way the eyewitnesses described it anyway. It wasn't like somebody was far away from them. The perpetrators were right up on top of Brent Miller. And, I mean, how did they get by without having any blood on their clothes? I don't know.
There was one bloody print at the scene of the killing, which did not match any of the four accused. Herman Wallace says prison records show he was already at his workstation around the time of the killing and that there was no possible way that he could leave the scene of the crime and be at his job without being seen and searched by security guards at various checkpoint gates. Because they had no other evidence, Louisiana prosecutor's case hinged on Brown's testimony. The state said the motive was racial hatred. Woodfox and Wallace say they were framed because their political activism threatened authorities. But they didn't stand a chance against the awesome power of the state. Their state-appointed attorneys proved to be ineffective. Their defense committee had been infiltrated by the FBI, and co-defendant Chester Jackson, nicknamed Noxzema, turned state's evidence against Herman Wallace.
Chester Jackson allowed the administration and the judicial system to pressure him into lying and saying he did something that he did not do, and take the stand when Hooks or Herman Wallace went to trial.
Despite evidence to the contrary, Woodfox and Wallace were convicted of Brent Miller's murder in 1973 and 74, respectively. Gilbert Montague was exonerated because prison records and eyewitness accounts from security personnel placed him in the hospital at the time of the murder. Sentenced to life in prison, Woodfox and Wallace continued to be held in the infamous CCR unit of Angola, where they were locked down for 23 hours a day. Nevertheless, their political activism continued unabated. Over the years, they helped hundreds of other inmates with counseling and legal work. Underlying all of their actions was the desire to create more humane conditions for prisoners. They fought against the brutality of guards, unnecessary strip searches, and they went on a 45-day hunger strike to protest the prison's degrading and unsanitary practice of serving meals to CCR inmates on the floor. They also won the right for contact visits.
When I got my first contact, it was around Christmas. And my mom and my sister, my brother, and my oldest niece by my sister came. And that was the point. I mean, I had always been able to kiss my mom through the screen, you know, touch fingers and stuff with Michael and everybody, but to actually hug my mom, you know, hold her in my arms, that was the first time in about 16 years. You
know. During the two decades following their murder convictions, Woodfox and Wallace obtained documents through the Freedom of Information Act that substantiated their claim they had been framed. Richard Becker with the International Action Center and the Angola 2 Defense Committee.
Hezekiah Brown testified that he had seen Albert Woodfox kill the guard who was killed, Brent Miller, and said he was the only eyewitness at the time, and testified under oath that he had not received any inducements or any promises from the prison officials or the state attorney general's office in exchange for this testimony. And we now have the documentary evidence in the form of letters that were written by the warden, Murray Henderson, who was the warden at the time, and subsequent wardens and other state officials recommending that Hezekiah Brown be given parole, that Hezekiah Brown be given a carton of cigarettes a week, that he be given other privileges and favors. But most important and most surprising would be that many state officials, high-ranking officials in the law enforcement administration of the state of Louisiana, would join together to seek parole, an early parole for Hezekiah Brown. He had been sentenced to death in the 1960s, and then that was commuted to life without the possibility of parole based on his either fourth or fifth aggravated rape conviction. It would be highly unusual for high-level law enforcement officials to all be joining together on a case like this within 2 or 3 years after a person had begun serving their sentence. I mean, to say that's unusual is an extreme understatement. So clearly what has come out in the years following the trial was that promises were made to Brown and that, in fact, his testimony was bought testimony. And this was the critical testimony in convicting Woodfox in that first trial.
You're listening to Freedom Without Behind Bars. It is produced by Leslie George. We're going to come back to the documentary in just a minute here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In 1993, Albert Woodfox finally won a retrial for the murder of prison guard Brent Miller. He was retried in the small Louisiana town where Miller is buried. We now go back to Leslie George's documentary, Freedom Behind Bars.
Woodfox was granted a second trial through the efforts of Angola inmate and former Black Panther Robert King Wilkerson.
He is the unsung hero of all of this. He's the one who put about 95% of my post-conviction together, which eventually led to my case being reversed in a new trial order. What the judge ruled is ineffective assistance of counsel. In his opinion, he talks about the unconstitutionality of the grand jury. The method that they used in Westfield Sound Parish discriminated against African Americans and women.
But reopening the case meant a new grand jury would weigh the evidence and decide whether or not to reindict Woodfox. One of the new jurors was Ann Butler, ex-wife of former Angola warden Murray Henderson. Some believe that alone should have been enough to keep her off the grand jury, but on top of that, she had written a book called Dying to Tell about Angola prison. The book contains a chapter about the Miller killing that includes a number of false statements, including that Woodfox had been convicted of rape. Nick Trentacosta, a lawyer for the Loyola Death Penalty Resource Center, says her presence on the grand jury tainted it.
I think it's unconscionable that a person who had done much investigation into Mr. Woodfox's case to write a book about it, had a fixed opinion about it, was allowed to sit on the grand jury. That's like having a shill. The government exactly knows. It's not a question. You don't have to present evidence to this woman. And as I understand it, and I'm not, again, speaking from personal knowledge, is that she was allowed to explain to the grand jury everything she thought she knew to be truth in order to assist them to reach their decision whether to indict Mr. Woodfox a second time. It's jury rigging is what it is.
The trial began December 7th, 1998, in Emmett, Louisiana, the small town where guard Brent Miller is buried, and it lasted 10 days. After deliberating for only 5.5 hours, the jury convicted Albert Woodfox for the second time.
That trial was a farce. That trial was a travesty of justice.
Richard Becker.
People were allowed to testify, giving completely, or the prosecution was allowed, in fact, to introduce into evidence, and the judge allowed this to happen, testimony that was completely hearsay testimony. For instance, there was a man on the stand who the prosecution was attempting to say had written a statement way back then in 1973, 10 months after the incident where the guard was killed, saying the prosecution said that he had made a statement describing the killing of the guard. He denied that he had ever made that statement. The statement only existed in the handwriting of a guard. It was not signed. It was not dated. The guard who was still alive and who had supposedly taken down the statement can't really remember it, according to what he said on the stand. And yet the jury was allowed to hear this. And the jury was allowed to hear other things that were not eyewitness testimony, but were in fact hearsay or unrelated information about the political beliefs, for instance, of Albert Woodfox, that created a completely prejudicial atmosphere in that courtroom. And I think that the lead attorney for Albert Woodfox, he had two court-appointed attorneys, has himself said in a petition to the court that his counsel was ineffective. So you had a high-powered prosecution. There were always at least six members of the state attorney general's office in the courtroom. There was a judge who was allowing hearsay, highly prejudicial hearsay testimony to be heard by the jury, and an ineffective defense for Albert Woodfox. And I think the combination of those factors and the fact that the courtroom was packed on the last day with guards in uniforms created a situation where it was pretty predictable that the jury was going to go along with what the state wanted, and that's what they did, and they found Albert Woodfox guilty again.
Prosecutor Collins says that what Becker calls prejudicial testimony, she calls evidence that might indicate a motive for the killing of Guard Miller.
In one letter that was written, he was talking about the requirement for bloodshed and the racist, fascist pigs, and basically talking about some sort of revolution. In another letter, he was talking about killing the white pigs, white fascist pigs. In one of the statements when he was in court in an unrelated hearing, he was raising his hands. His hands were shackled at the time because of problems that he had caused in the courtroom and on an earlier occasion, and he had raised his hands and was turning around facing the prospective jurors, shaking the handcuffs at him, saying basically, look at what the white man's justice has done to me now. This was prior to him even going to Angola in 1971.
As for the defense's charge that it was the witness, Hezekiah Brown, who had the motive to lie because of all the perks he got, ultimately he went from life without parole to freedom, Prosecutor Cullen says his benefits were irrelevant.
I don't think there's anything that I have found or that the defense found or that anyone has presented to me to show me that what benefits Hezekiah got, and I'm not arguing that he didn't get any benefits. He obviously did. I'm not arguing that. My position is that it was after the fact, and based on all of the evidence and the deal, if you want to call it a deal, that he got, there's nothing in there that causes me any concern about his credibility. If somebody does a favor for you, you are going to try to help them. I mean, there's not a prosecutor that's been working longer than maybe 2 months that is not going to have been involved in a situation where if you need information from somebody, you're going to have to make a deal with them.
One of the jurors, Nita Gorell, says ultimately it was Brown's testimony that convinced the jury Woodfox was guilty.
For me, that was the biggest thing. Yes, we had a problem with the fact that there was no physical evidence that could be proven to be linked to Mr. Woodfox. There was a knife, and there were fingerprints, and we heard lots of testimony about them, but nothing linked them to him. And I believe that their main case was the eyewitness account of Hezekiah Brown.
Gorell says that when Woodfox testified he passed a lie detector test proving he didn't kill the guard, he went too far.
I think that his slipping that information in may have turned the jury off. It did me. I believe Albert Woodfox knew that that was not admissible, that we weren't supposed to hear it. He's had a long time in court. He obviously took a very active role in his defense, and I'm sure he knew that that was not to be admitted evidence.
Woodfox's lawyer, Burt Garraway, believes he will be granted yet another trial.
They have convicted an innocent man. Some court somewhere is going to say, hey, this is wrong, you know, this is wrong.
Albert Woodfox will be sentenced on Tuesday, February 23rd. It is fully expected that he will get life without parole. He also expects to be returned to solitary confinement at Angola Prison, where he has resided for the last quarter of a century. Pamela Mabel, Albert Woodfox's sister-in-law.
When they voted him guilty, he said, they will never break my spirit. They will never break my spirit. And I tell you, that was all we needed to hear.
If you are not willing to struggle, if you are not willing to sacrifice, then you can never change things. Struggle is the essence of change. And that's how I try to live my life. Yes, I paid a heavy toll for it, but I don't have one regret. If I knew everything that was going to happen to me, and I could turn back the hand of time, I would not change one thing about my life. Not one moment of dedication, not one moment of struggle, not one moment of physical pain that I've suffered from beatings by prison people in New York and in Angola. I would change nothing. I don't know what's up there
beyond the sky. Freedom Behind Bars is produced by Leslie George. It was edited and written with Dred Scott Keyes. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In these last few minutes of the program, I wanted to pursue a few points raised in Leslie's documentary. First of all, while she talked a great deal about Albert Woodfox, got a chance to interview him, as he is in jail right now, and before his final sentencing will be there, then heads back to Angola prison, we expect. We didn't hear as much about Herman Wallace, and we're joined on the phone right now by Malik Rahim, who is the organizer of the Angola 2 Defense Committee. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Malik.
Okay, thank you.
The case of Herman Wallace, while Albert Woodfox did get a new trial, although he was convicted in that second trial, Herman Wallace didn't. Where does he stand right now?
Well, Herman is in a very difficult situation right now because Herman is filing for his for an appeal of his conviction. He is without an attorney, and it basically only Robert King Wilkerson has been assisting him, who is also a member of the Panther Party that is incarcerated in CCR with him. So right now he's in a very precarious situation.
We just heard in Leslie George's piece that Albert Woodfox will be sentenced on Tuesday, most likely sentenced to life without parole.
Yes, not for life.
for listeners who are interested in the case, are interested in doing something about it, is that basically a done deal? Can it go anywhere else?
Alba's conviction?
Yes.
Alba's conviction, only thing that can stop him now from spending the rest of his life in prison is if your interested audience would get involved. It's going to take a people's movement to sit, weigh out the evidence of this case, and once they see the type of injustice that has been inflicted upon Albert and Herman, call the governor of the state of Louisiana and let him know and demand and ask him to hold an investigation upon this injustice, and to also demand of him that the safety of not only Herman and Albert, but all those courageous inmates who came and testified in their behalf, that their safety be monitored. Without this, I am very fearful that what happened to George Jackson, that an escape attempt from maximum security will be held, in which they will frame Herman and Albert, saying that they have done something in the course of that attempt, and kill them both.
Can you explain what you mean, that the authorities would say that they tried to escape and then use that as an excuse to kill them?
Yes. Last month, right after Albert's trial, one of the persons that came to testify on his behalf was a Caucasian inmate who later, I can't recall his name right now, but later when he was sent back to prison, allegedly was a part of an escape attempt in which one inmate, they say, killed himself rather than go back to prison. Since then, they have been trying to implicate Herman into that escape attempt. Since Albert's conviction, Herman has been moved 6 times to different cells and different parts of CCR. Which is the maximum housing unit for the Angola prison. So the groundwork is already in place, you know, because they're already saying that it was escape. One inmate has gotten killed. Now they're saying that Herman has been implicated into that escape. So the groundwork is already set for them to say that he tried to escape now. And now we had to kill both or all the members of the party that's still confined in CCR.
And when you say CCR, for listeners perhaps who are just joining us, you mean solitary confinement?
Yes.
Malik Rahim, who heads up the defense committee for Albert Wood Fox and Herman Wallace. Well, that does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Again, one more time, the phone number of the Louisiana Governor, Mike Foster, is 225-342-7015. His fax number, 225-342-7099. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!